Sharing the passion for Mars, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society, with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. The Humans to Mars Summit returned to the U.S. Capitol in mid-May. We'll share the closing panel of Martian All-Stars and their inspiring words. Then it will be time for our regular What's Up segment with Planetary Society Chief Scientist Bruce Betts. Astronomers always wish each other clear skies, but Planetary Society Senior Editor Emily Lakdawalla reminds us that there's a lot to be said for other fluffy objects in the sky, no matter where that sky is. Welcome back, Emily. You know, one of the prettiest sights we get to witness here on Earth, at least in my humble opinion, it's so interesting to learn that there is a direct parallel to this on Mars, and that in both cases, this phenomenon has a name that I've never heard before.
Yes, we're talking about noctilucent clouds, and you can figure out what that means by looking at the word roots. So noctis, night, and lucent, light. So these are clouds that shine even after sunset because they're so high in elevation that to them, the sun is still up. You can see them in certain seasons. It's especially helpful to have long sunsets. So at northern latitudes and far southern latitudes, you're more likely to see them. It also helps to have very high altitude water, making these wispy cirrus clouds. They just light up like these ethereal, feathery constructions. They're just gorgeous. And Curiosity has been seeing and even filming them on Mars in the last couple of weeks.
These are really stunning videos. I know we throw that word around a lot here, but then there's a lot of stunning stuff on and also above Mars. Tell us about these animations.
Well, what we're looking at are photos taken with the NavCam camera on Curiosity. That's the widest angle camera that it can routinely point at the sky. And so it gives you this view of the landscape. The landscape is quite dark because it's after sunset. And then above it, you see these wispy clouds with a bright area of the sky just off to the left edge where the sun has most recently set. The clouds move across the sky in several images, and you can actually see darkness catching up on them from the right as you watch the animation. It's really lovely.
Hats off again to some of your amateur image processing colleagues who got this stuff to us. One of them, he took these three images, and it's absolutely smooth. It's great work here.
That's the magic of tweening. There's lots of software out there that'll do that for you, that'll take images that were several images taken over time and kind of morph them into each other. It doesn't work well for everything, but for this application, it's perfect. And the images just, they tween so smoothly and you get this sense of time passing and the clouds drifting along.
And you close with a topper, and that is the same thing, but in color, which was not easy to do.
Well, no, because the color was painted in. It had to be made up. This camera is not a color camera. It's not capable of taking color images. And the color camera on the rover doesn't have as wide a field of view. So you couldn't get a view like this from MESCAM. Justin Cowart, he took images, he looked at images that were taken by color cameras to show what the sunset would look like in color. And he painted those colors in to give us a sense of what it would have looked like if we were standing there.
Check these out, folks. It is a brand new blog entry from Emily Lakdawalla, senior editor of the Planetary Society, and they are, of course, at planetary.org. Its title is Curiosity Gazes Upon Noctilucent Clouds Over Gale Crater. Thank you, Emily.
Thank you, Matt.
She is also the editor-in-chief of the Planetary Report, with a new edition of that available online in just a few weeks. So that's something else to watch for on planetary.org from our planetary evangelist. Each year, Explore Mars gathers space exploration leaders and pioneers in Washington, D.C. for the organization's Humans to Mars Summit. It has been my honor and great pleasure to participate for several years. I host the live webcast that fills the time during breaks in the program, but also contains all of the fascinating sessions. You can enjoy it on the Explore Mars website. We've got a link on this week's show page at planetary.org/radio. In addition to the webcast, I generally get to moderate a couple of discussions on the summit stage. Like last year, the very last of these sessions brings a big group up to answer a key question or two. What's remarkable is the diversity of this panel, not just in the human sense, but in the expertise they offer. As you'll hear, they are united in their passion for Mars, and that includes the moon, if it makes sense to go there first. By the way, a pretty good case was made for just that during the summit. Here are a few highlights from the conversation held on May 16th, 2019, at the close of this year's proceedings. The entire session can be heard, and it's worth listening to, in the podcast version of this week's show that you can also find at planetary.org/radio. Let me go down the line here. You know Sonia Gavankar because she's been up there co-hosting the webcast with me for the last 2 days. Director of Public Affairs, Public Relations, I'm sorry, at the museum right here in town. Next, Jim Garvin, a participant in this little shindig last year, chief scientist of the Goddard Space Flight Center, former chief scientist of all of NASA, and it would probably be quicker to mention the list of, give you the list of missions he has not been involved in than to tell you all the ones he's had a part of. You're part of the InSight team right now, right?
Oh, InSight.
Back on Mars, our newest Martian. Next to him is Kelly Girardi, aerospace professional, popular science communicator. You saw her on the social media panel. She has flown... Social media planet. Everybody has their smartphones out all the time.
All the time.
Who has flown multiple microgravity research campaigns as a payload specialist and as a human test subject. Which I wish we had time to talk about that. She's a scientist astronaut candidate with Project Possum, the first crewed suborbital research program. So hoping to get up there pretty soon, I bet.
Hoping, waiting for my ride.
Next in line, you've heard from Joe Cassidy several times of Aerojet Rocketdyne, the gold sponsor of the Humans to Mars Summit, by the way. He is that company's executive director of space. He is also the executive VP of this organization, Explore Mars. Allison Renault, next to him, was with NASA HQ, is now an independent consultant and motivational speaker working with nations around the world. You mentioned Croatia to us during one of the breaks out there, about countries that want space programs because they know how they're going to benefit their citizens. Last but far from least, Artemis Westenberg is president emerita of Explore Mars. Moving on now to create Explore Mars Europe. All right, everybody, let's get into it. We're going to start, Jim, because you are right next door there, we're going to start with you. The first of the questions that we want to ask is for each of you to tell us in as brief a period as possible the two most important lessons that you're going to take home from this year's summit. Jim?
Well, the first lesson is really a global one that transcends just this summit, and it's simply this. Mars is so much more than a destination. To me, it's a state of mind. And so as we look at the real Mars, as we get close to it for these Ansel Adams-esque images from Curiosity, look at what you see. You see the beauty of the place, but it's more than the place. Hidden in the rockscapes, in the stories, is a magical mystery tour of what really Mars is like. And that's one of the reasons why this conference, this meeting, the meetings we've had for the last 8 or 9 are so important. They make Mars a state of our minds. We're going. And the last, and my final one, is that the moon is not a digression from Mars. It's an essential element of our experience to make Mars that state of mind. As we go anywhere, we learn how to go somewhere, that somewhere being Mars. For me, I think the moon is really a very special element in the path to Mars. It's part of the Earth-Moon system, so we gotta go somewhere before we go there. And I just remind you one thing. 500 years ago, a bunch of ships sailed around this planet and made the first orbit, and they stopped somewhere before they went. And so I think the moon is a key element in our path to Mars, and I can't wait till these women get to go there.
Kelly, it's your turn.
Okay, I'm going to do one major takeaway. And for me, it's perception right now. I think what we're seeing while this conference is going out, if you look at the partisan politics that are affecting space right now, and if we have to be really clear about what we're up against, you know, we have a program, a roadmap that can get us to Mars. We have, you know, Artemis, we're going to go to the moon, we're going to send a woman, we're going to have, you know, a pathway to Mars. This is the stuff that should unite a nation. And already we're in a political storm that makes it we'll hope it's likely that it happens, but, you know, it may not. And the thing that we have to understand is that part of this is a failure of our political system. Part of this is a failure of our industry. You know, I think we've been riding the wave of space is cool for a little bit too long and letting all of this excitement speak for itself. And if we're not equipping folks with the mental frameworks and the mental models to understand why it's not only exciting, but also essential, then we're creating fair weather fans, where the subtext is, it's cool, but it's frivolous, or worse, it's the pet project of an old boys club, right? We need to make sure that we're not only lobbying Congress, but we're lobbying the public. And then my final thought is, I think we need to do a better job of equipping our politicians with good, satisfying answers to their constituents who are going to be asking, why are you prioritizing this when funding for my programs are being cut, when Flint still doesn't have clean water? You know, when 20% of the children in the United States have food insecurity, we know that space is an investment in our future. We need to do better about communicating that to everyone.
Bravo. All right. You've set a good tone. Joe, you're up.
All right. My lesson learned is the word and. Heard it a couple of times already. It's not the moon or Mars. It's not commercial or NASA. We're going to all be part of this. So the word is and. And for a lot of folks, I think they're surprised by this, but we've been looking at the moon as a part of this path to Mars for quite a while. We started off at a point where some of the Mars advocates were saying we need to deorbit the ISS, bring it down, and use all that money to go to Mars. The first conference we held was called ISS and Mars. We put those communities together, and today, those two communities are working very effectively with each other to achieve that goal of going to Mars. And that's exactly what we're doing now with the lunar advocates and the Mars advocates. We're going to go to Mars, we're going to go there through the moon, and we'll all do it. We'll all be part of it. International, commercial, academia, NASA, big companies like mine, small companies like some of yours. It's all inclusive. Remember that.
Excellent. I got one more and. Robots and humans.
And humans, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely,
and
Matt. Very good.
And microbes. they go everywhere.
They do.
With the robots with and the humans.
Yeah, I want to make sure. Wait a moment.
Allison.
Well, it is true. I have 11 children. I'm trying to do my best to put people in the workforce, space workforce. My oldest is a nuclear engineer. My fifth actually is the HR director for Elon Musk. My seventh is pre-med pediatric space medicine, and number 11 just won the engineering award at her school. So I think it's important that we, you know, invest in our own families as well. One thing that I was thinking is Dr. John Logsdon always brings up, will we ever have another Kennedy moment? And I don't know if we'll have a Kennedy moment. There's a Greek word that I love that's called a kairos moment. And a kairos moment is, Webster says, is a time when conditions are right for the accomplishment of a crucial action. And this is what I see listening to all of our panels and all of our speakers, is we have kind of a hyper-convergence suddenly in time where we have political will. I wrote down here we have a great technological foundation, a lot of research. We have billionaires. We have entrepreneurs who are very committed. We have international partnerships. I worked in international at headquarters, and I saw the expansion of partnerships from the UAE to a lot of smaller nations, emerging space nations. And mostly what I see as I travel the world and speak around the world is I see NASA t-shirts everywhere.
Yeah.
And even in Africa, I see children dressing up like astronauts. We see movies, we see Netflix, we see television shows, and documentaries. So the public is very ripe as well. So all this coming together in one big picture, I think as a space force together, we have a choice to make. We can either do strike three, or we can hit it out of the ballpark.
As my boss, the science guy, says, the best brand the United States has is NASA, which means the best brand is space, really. Artemis, you get to wrap up this one.
Well, for me, what I take from this conference, seventh, and having had conferences since 2011, I think what I learned is that what I feared that Mars would be an all-American party is not going to come to pass. it is indeed going to be an international party, and it might be Europe, and it might be many more, and that's fine, because humanity should go back to the moon and onto Mars, and not just, you know, a group on this continent. So that's what I take from here, and it is heartening, really, really helping me also to transition to my next job. So thank you.
Okay. My takeaway, the progress that is being made on all the various fronts, all of which are huge challenges and must be met if we're going to first put humans back on the moon very soon and then reach Mars. There was so much evidence across the conference today that this is happening, folks. I mean, from what we're going to eat to what we're going to live in and how we're going to get there. It really is happening. And it's very encouraging.
That was the first of two lightning rounds during the closing Humans to Mars panel discussion. After the break, we'll cut to a question from the audience that allowed our Martians to provide their visions for the Moon and Mars in the year 2045. I hope you'll stay with us. This is Planetary Radio.
40 years ago, my professor, Carl Sagan, shared his dream of exploring the cosmos with solar sails. The Planetary Society's LightSail 2 will soon become the first small spacecraft to be propelled only by the light of the sun. I'm Bill Nye, and I'll be there as a rocket carries our craft into orbit. Tens of thousands of members have made this day possible. Already part of our LightSail team? Thank you. It's never too late to join us. You can learn more at planetary.org/membership.
Hey, Planetary Radio listeners. The Planetary Society now has an official online store. We've teamed up with Chop Shop, known for their space mission posters, to bring you space-inspired art and merchandise. You can find exclusive Planetary Society t-shirts, posters, and more. Visit planetly/spaceshop to learn more. That's planet.ly/spaceshop.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society, taking you back to that last very special panel discussion at this year's Humans to Mars Summit. In this last excerpt, you'll again hear Sonia Gavankar of the Newseum in Washington, D.C., Goddard Space Flight Center Chief Scientist Jim Garvin, Science Communicator and Payload Specialist Kelly Girardi, Joe Cassidy of Aerojet Rocketdyne, and Artemis Westenberg, President Emerita of Explore Mars.
All right, we will go right on to the last audience question of the 2019 HTM. That's apocryphal.
Okay. I love the excitement that we've got for 2044 and 2033. I want to ask you all about 2045. Where do you see us on Mars in 2045? Where are we on the moon? Where are we in Leo? Are we anywhere else in the solar system, and why?
Great question. I mean, we can go right down the line.
I'm just going to turn my head. I mean, 2045, I have a six-year-old who absolutely wants to be an astronaut. I think, you know, he's going to be, you know, FaceTiming me from Mars, and I'm going to be standing at the airport, you know, waiting to board my commuter jet to one of the planets.
So I think, great comment. First, I think how we are there doesn't even matter. It's that we feel we're there. And if it's a virtual presence, where we're there every second, not just with the weather, but walking down the holodeck on Mars and feeling as if it's part of our lives, I think that's a real possibility. Secondly, I think Mars will have delivered the goods. We will realize from Mars we're not alone. Huh. And that microbial universe, which is everywhere, is manifested there in some way that I can't predict. Next, the next few years are going to be unbelievable. We will open our eyes to the universe with James Webb that will inspire us to go far beyond Mars. We won't be talking a few light years. We will be seeing this universe through the lens of Mars, and that's going to make things great. So I hope there's tons of women and men on Mars and some dogs making music so we're all having fun, because that's part of our culture, and that we all feel we're part of it.
When I think of the future similar to Sonia, I also think of my child. I have a little girl. Her name is Delta V because, you know, runs deep. Right. But I, you know, when she was 3 months old, I brought her to the Falcon Heavy launch, the first one, and just seeing and hearing the sound barrier break over her head, similar to, I think, what Bailey mentioned about being part of this next generation. Mm-hmm. You know, I look at the things that she's going to see in these coming decades. It's the democratization of access to space. It's the expansion of Earth's economic sphere. It's the promise and the hope of our entire globe being lifted into a more civilized way of life, and I want that for her, and that drives me in the industry.
What a great start in life. Joe, 2045?
Okay, Robert. So we've been at the moon for 20 years in 2045. So by now, we're up and running. We're producing propellant. We're shipping it up to evolved gateway-like propellant depots that are in different NRHO orbits around the moon. And we're using that as our jumping-off point to go out to Mars. And based on what Hoppy's laid out, I think we could have about 6 or 7 missions by that point to get to Mars. So we've built our little Antarctic-like research station out at Mars, and we're shipping crews out every 2 years, every synodic period. Somebody else is going out to Mars. That's where I think we're going to be.
I don't just want boots on Mars. I want a shoe store on Mars.
Nice.
And like Jim, maybe even beyond, I want to know that we are not alone in this universe, because that just seems, as somebody said, like an awful lot of wasted space. I want to know that that life is as much a part of what the universe is about as any other physical property. Artemis, you get the last word on that question, and you get to take us out of this grand gathering.
Well, 2045, we've been on Mars for 12 years. We've learned to do it the hard way. It will be hard. It will not be easy, but we've learned to persevere, and we will have learned to really trust each other and depend on each other. So in 2045, I believe we will have a better society here on Earth, because we will learn from what we see there. Our vanguard that's on Mars will teach us that it is possible to live with each other, that it is possible to respect each other, that borders are actually something you put on a paper map on your desk, but then in reality, they're not really there, because we're all human beings. That's what I believe.
Nice.
Well done.
For our entire panel.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. The chief scientist of the Planetary Society is here once again, as he always is, for this segment of the show. That's Bruce Betts. Welcome.
Hi, man.
That was very enthusiastic. I'm ready to hear about the night sky, and it has been a really pretty night sky down here in the San Diego area.
It's been mostly cloudy up here in the Pasadena area, but had some clear nights recently, a little bit. Saw Jupiter. It looks wonderful. Look in the east in the early evening, even now, certainly by mid-evening, it's the brightest star-like object out there right now, with Venus hiding. You can check out Mars also, but it looks kind of dim and reddish and very low down in the west shortly after sunset. And then in the middle of the night, we've got Saturn coming up in the east, looking kind of yellowish. All right, on to this week in space history. 100 years since the solar eclipse that was used to test the general theory of relativity, and unfortunately found it to be correct.
Did you say unfortunately?
Oh, totally.
You
My
don't like
God,
that.
It's complicated. I still try to pass it off as Einstein's practical joke on everyone, but I keep testing things. I keep finding it's right, but it's really, you know, complicated when you get into the equations. I don't really enjoy it. Could you do something about that?
I could try. Mostly, I'm glad I was a liberal arts major. I will say that next week, our guest, Jay Pasikoff, the great astronomer historian of astronomy, is going to mention that fact as well, because he also was celebrating that 100th anniversary. I mean, you know, he is a famous eclipse chaser, and of course, that is one of the ways to help work these things out. That's what happened 100 years ago, right?
Yep. All right, we move on to...
There's kind of a snake oil quality to that.
So pulsars, as you know, are a kind of neutron star that spins and has beams of light. That light, at whatever wavelength, passes by the Earth. We see it as like a lighthouse. We see a beacon from the spinning. From that, the fastest pulsar spins that we've detected, the fastest spins at 716 times per second. This is something with the mass of a star, the size of a city, 716 times per second. Hurts my brain almost as much as general relativity.
I just think of the note that somebody put down when they found the first one, LGM, for Little yeah. Green Men, because they figured it had to be intelligence, but no such luck.
Is that fortunate or unfortunate? Yeah, it's philosophy. All right, let's go to trivia. I asked you about how wide an area was observed to have changed due to the Hayabusa 2 SCI impact into the asteroid Ryugu when they shot it with a projectile. How do we do, Matt?
Entrance a bit depressed this time because I think it was a little bit of work to figure it out. A lot of people came up with the answer 20 meters, but we should point out that that 20 meters, which I think is also what you got, that's not actually the size of the main crater, right?
That's why it was phrased as area observed to have changed. Taken directly from a Jason Davis article about the Hayabusa 2's SCI on the Planetary Society website, by the way.
Jason Davis, our colleague, writing regularly for the Planetary Society blog. So 20 meters or 66 feet approximately, and that is the answer that we got, get this, from Mel Powell. Mel, who gets quoted all the time because he's always sending us funny stuff for the show. But in the 4 years that I think he has been entering the contest, this is his first win there in Sherman Oaks, California. Congratulations, Mel.
The cruelty of random.org.
It's really true. We're ready, I believe, for yet another question.
What is the brightest pulsar as seen from Earth at radio wavelengths? Radio, Matt, radio. Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
All right, and you have this time until June 5, that's Wednesday, June 5th at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us this answer. Not only will someone out there chosen by random.org win a Planetary Society rubber asteroid, and an iTelescope.net account. It's an account worth a couple hundred bucks American from that nonprofit worldwide network of telescopes. I have this embarrassing wealth of books that we have received lately, most of which I will not, you know, have time to talk to the authors about. A lot of them are about the upcoming Apollo anniversary. Well, the Apollo 11 anniversary, as you have pointed out, we've had a bunch of ongoing Apollo anniversaries, right?
Yes.
Well, here is a book by James Donovan, which Mike Collins, the command module pilot for Apollo 11, said, this is the best book on Apollo that I have read. Shoot for the Moon from James Donovan. We're going to throw that in for the winner of this week's contest, this brand new one that Bruce has just laid on you. Shoot for the Moon, the Space Race, and the Extraordinary Voyage of Apollo 11.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up in the night sky, and think about Matt singing your favorite poem. Thank you, and good night.
Yeah, oh, I'm going to be inundated now, I'm sure, by a singable poetry. Paul Simon, you'll go to the top of the list if you send one. That's Bruce Betts. He's the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by our members who'd like to be some of those humans who go to Mars. Mary Luz Bender is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which was arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan, at Astro.